Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to The Hidden Djinn, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
Hi, and welcome to this very special bonus series of The Hidden Djinn, The Interviews. In these episodes, you'll hear me talk to people from all walks of life who have had djinn experiences, are drawn to the stories of djinn, and draw lessons from these stories. You'll hear from artists, scholars, writers, journalists, and djinn exorcists, and even from me, as I discuss how and why this series came about in a very personal conversation with my husband. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. I'm so excited to bring you this guest this week. His name is Baxter Jackson, and I found Baxter when I was doing my research for The Hidden Djinn well before the show ever aired, and he was gracious enough, even though he was halfway across the world and had just begun a vacation. He lives in the Gulf region, and he was vacationing up in Europe. And but I managed to nail him down, and we did a transatlantic interview. So I came across Baxter when I found a couple of articles he had written. He's a journalist, along with many other things he does, about things he had witnessed himself in a place that's one of the most haunted regions, apparently, in the world, Bahla in Oman. And I was so fascinated with his experience that I really wanted to talk to him, and I thought you guys would love to hear from him. So I've been holding on this interview for so long. And since this week's episode is all about summoning the djinn, I thought this was kind of like a perfect time to air it. So let me tell you a little bit about Baxter. Baxter Jackson is a writing instructor at a university in the desert oasis of Al Ain in the United Arab Emirates. While living in the Middle East for the past 13 years, including stints in Egypt, Oman, and again, the UAE, he has been crafting unique cultural interest stories about his experiences for travel websites such as Lonely Planet, the Matador Network, and local publications such as Outdoor UAE. You can find Baxter on YouTube and Instagram. Again, it's Baxter Jackson. And, well, come and join me as I speak to Baxter. It's a great conversation. Hi, Baxter. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
So, you know, I want to start off by talking just about, I've told our listeners a little bit about your work in journalism and specifically kind of like the work you've done in the Middle East. Can you tell us about your body of work and how you ended up doing that?
Well, I was, I just happened to get an opportunity to teach at the American University in Cairo. And when I was there, that was sort of my introduction to the Middle East. And I've always been interested in, you know, paranormal phenomenon. I've always had kind of a longing to believe that there's something else out there, you know, some other side to life that we don't get to see. And so that's
what that, were you that teaching didn't... something? Were you teaching something related to like paranormal phenomena? Or
No, not at all. I was working at a writing center, basically like a writing tutor, and on a scholarship at AUC. So. Yeah, but that was my introduction to the Middle East, and but I'd never written about you know, paranormal phenomena before. I happened to find myself years later in Oman, which is where you find Bahla, which is like the kind of the epicenter of all things that go bump in the night. For as far as you know, in the Muslim world goes, they don't. If any Arab has ever heard of Oman, then they know about it from Bahla. It's like Bahla's, you know, you say it in a whisper kind of thing.
Yeah, my introduction to Bahla and how it is like kind of this hotbed of activity. Actually, I didn't know this until I found your article, and I was so excited mm-hmm. to read it. And it was a fascinating piece, and I'm going to link it for everybody so they can read it as well. And I have referenced mm-hmm. it in the series. And so But that was like your first introduction to the world of gin, or I'm assuming it couldn't have been. You must have heard about this before that.
Well, no, I mean, I heard about genies, of course. I mean, in popular culture in the West, you know, we see genies in like Aladdin and movies like that. And so, yeah, and I Dream a Genie. I mean, I was born in the 70s, so I grew up with I Dream a Genie, but I never thought like, okay, this is a real thing or not. You know, I mean, I just thought it was like one of these, you know, popular myths or whatever. Sure.
So at what point did you realize that there are people who think this is a real thing? Was it during that story in Oman, or was it before that? Like, was there any other interaction for that?
Well, no, I mean, I had a couple of experiences in, when I was living in Cairo that made me realize that, you know, that most Muslims consider jinn to be, you know, just as real as God or the Prophet Muhammad or any other, you know, part of anything that's in the Quran. They take it mostly is taken literally, you know, and a lot of people, you know, I started to hear stories about jinn or like weird things that would happen and people would say, oh, it's a jinn, you know. And, but, you know, for me, it was just kind of like, okay, it's like a gremlin did it, you know, like, or something like that, you know, like right. In the West.
They've experienced something they can't explain, so they're just kind of projecting onto it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So tell me, okay, the Oman story starts off with you kind of waiting for a woman who's going to be joining you to mm-hmm. get exercise, basically. And so there's a story before that. Like, how did she hear of you? How did you connect with her? And why did you decide to like, oh yeah, this is something I totally want to be part of?
Well, yeah, that's, I'd written a story about Mualim Salim. She is like the most famous exorcist in Bahla. And I was living in Nizwa, Oman, which is about maybe 40 kilometers away. And so I'd written a story about him, and she saw it online, and then she wanted to, and she turns out she actually was possessed by a jinn, or had been possessed by a jinn for many years. And she had actually gone to Sharjah before to meet with a medium or a woman, a Syrian woman there who could sort of like a soothsayer, or like she, you know, sort of a gypsy type where she could predict your future or see what's wrong with you and, you know, kind of tell, give you a diagnosis. And she was the one who confirmed her suspicions that she is actually possessed by a jinn. And then she went to see a sheikh in Sharjah, and that helped for a little while, but the problem persisted. So she,
this woman wasn't like from the region, right? Like, she flew from the other side of the world.
She's from Rhode Island actually, but living in Boston. And her only connection to the Middle East was, I mean, she has Middle Eastern friends that she made because she was tutoring some students studying there in Boston who happened to have, you know, Middle Eastern background. And so that was her only connection. She'd been to like Dubai, and she'd been to a few other different places in the Middle East a few times, and had some kind of like import export business. You know, she would get things that people needed in different parts of the world. But other than that, like no Middle Eastern background whatsoever. Like, not.
Oh, and she wasn't Muslim herself, and she wasn't Muslim.
No, not even.
Did she talk to you about what those problems look like? I mean, like, she's traveling across the world to get help for her issues. What was she experiencing?
Yeah. She said that she would have like these night terrors. Like, she would just wake up and like, you know, in a sweat, and she felt like someone was in the room with her. And like, and then when she did feel that presence, she felt like someone was pushing down on her chest. She had like an abnormally heavy menstrual cycle. I think it was a left or I can't remember which eye it was, but it clouded over, and she went to see a doctor, and that didn't, like, you know, in traditional Western doctor, and nothing seemed to work. And she's, you know, and she began to become like increasingly paranoid, and you know, she wasn't getting sleep, and it was just, she felt like her life was out of control, you know. And so she was desperate enough to, you know, start doing research, and then she ran across the article that I had written for Matador about this guy Mualim Salim, and she contacted me, and she said, you know, I'm an American, I live in Boston, and I have a jinn problem, but I'm not crazy, you know. And then of course my first thought was, oh, she must be. But so I thought, you know, I'm open to new experiences, and I've already met with him once, and it would really be no problem. I would go to Muscat all the time from Nizwa anyways for the weekend to go skateboarding or hang out with my friends. So, you know, it was like no sweat off my back. So I thought, you know, why not? I'll meet her and see what her story is and put her in contact with this guy and we'll see what happens.
So, okay, can we talk a little bit about how the first piece came about? Was it just that when you moved to Amman and you heard about him, or like how did that happen?
Yeah, well, I heard about him from my students. Well, I heard about Bahla from my students. You know, like they wouldn't even
like
want
this haunted town type of
yeah,
place.
Right. Yeah, and so you just like they're so paranoid about it, they're not comfortable talking about jinn at all. You know, like as soon as you say jinn, then like Bismillah, you know, and then they want the jinn to go away. That's how you get a jinn to go away. You say Bismillah. But anyways, they think it's like bad karma or just, it's like courting bad luck or ill fortune to even talk about jinns. But anyways, I learned about him or about Bahla in general, you know, the reputation of Bahla from my students. But then one of my colleagues, she's Omani, and you know, I asked her like, do you know anyone who actually, so I asked her about it, about, you know, do you know anyone who does this kind of thing? Cause I was really curious to see what, you know, how it might differ from like the exorcist I've seen in movies and things like that. You know, right. What's the Islamic slant on it, you know? And she did a little poking around and she put me in contact with him. And that's how we met.
What was that meeting like?
It was kind of weird. He was sort of enigmatic. I mean, he was like, my Arabic wasn't that good at that point, so I had to have a translator with me. But he was open enough to meet with us and, suffer through my questions. And he was a nice guy, and he didn't seem like a magician or like any kind of, I mean, I wouldn't have noticed him like walking down the street. He didn't like stand out. He just seemed like a typical old Omani dude. You know, he was, he'd been in the army and he'd seen all the changes that Oman had gone through. Like when, you know, slavery was still in effect there in like the 60s. And he saw the changes and, you know, how there was like nothing there at that point and like in the 60s and even not until the 70s when Sultan Qaboos took power did it really start to, you know, move from a backwater into like a first world nation. So he'd seen all that. So he's a pretty wise, interesting guy.
So when you met him, and look, I've met some folks who claim to, you know, be involved in this kind of stuff, and some of them right off the bat you're like, this person is like a total con artist. Like,
right,
did you get any sense of that, or did he seem like he was really sincere?
No, I think he genuinely believes in what he's doing, and I think he claims to have helped over 5,000 people in, you know, during his whole tenure as a mu'allim to get rid of jinn. And so I mean, and I've heard lots of stories from other people about him. So, yeah, I mean, he seemed like the real deal.
So you travel, he lives in Bahla, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you travel to the most haunted place in the, I guess, in the Middle East. And how is that? I mean, did you get a set, like, what's that place like?
Well, it looks like a typical little sleepy, like, mountain hamlet, you know? I mean, it's just, the Western Hajar mountains, and they're pretty rugged and desolate, and it looks a lot like Mars. Actually, if you've never been to Oman, it looks like that's they could film Mars there easily, or a movie about Mars there, you know. Yeah. And it's just a little town. There's a souk, and it's nothing really remarkable about it, except that there is a castle there, and that castle is like kind of the one of the hot spots for paranormal activity in Bahla, because they've been trying to restore it since like the 90s. And every time they go in and they do something, then they come back the next day and it's been undone. And a lot of people say, well, it's the jinn, you know, they don't like their people coming in and messing with the place where they're haunting. So that's why it's taken so long for it to finally open. I think it was open just a couple of years ago, finally.
I guess the jinn like their ruins ruined. They don't want renovation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they need the atmosphere, I guess.
Did you spend much time there? Did you stay the night? Were you like trying to like see if you could
Unfortunately, you can't do that. I would have loved to do that. It would have been very like a Scooby-Doo kind of thing. Yeah, no, spend the night in the castle, you mean, or in Bahla itself?
I mean, either, yeah. But the castle.
Oh, no. No, I didn't do that. And I never spent the night in Bahla, but I did wander around the souk. And the souk has an interesting, there's a what my students call the leading tree. So supposedly there were some people that were someone who was suspected of practicing witchcraft. I think in the it was sometime between the 12th and the 14th century. And anyway, so they executed a few people who they suspected to be witches there and on this particular tree. And so this tree, my students told me that if you just touch this tree, you'll be cursed and all these horrible things will happen to you. And so I had to go see it, of course, and I had to touch it. And so I'm still
tempting fate.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I want to see something, you know, like that. I've always had a longing for there to be something else, you know, besides this, you know, there's got to be something else out there.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When you say that you have always felt like there's something out there, what is like kind of like the framework of your beliefs? Is it kind of like in a religious sense, or is it kind of like in a supernatural sense, or is it just like your childhood stories that have stuck with you? What do you think's out there?
I have no idea, you know, really. But I have a feeling that from the things that I've seen and the other stories and the stories that I've been told, I'd like to think that there's something else out there, you know, some kind of power greater than myself, you know, that's controlling and pulling the strings, you know, like in the puppet show or something. When I was in my 20s, I was really into Carlos Castaneda, and so I read a lot of his stuff and went to Mexico and followed some of the things that he does in his books to try to recreate, you know, his experiences. I've always just been a fan of those kind of stories, you know, because of, I think it's some kind of human longing for there to be something else besides this world. You know, I think it's really comforting, and any kind of evidence, even if it's scary or, even if you would not like to have any kind of face-to-face encounter with it, it is, I think it's reassuring to know that there is something else, you know. And I think that's why people look to religion and they look to, you know, they want to believe these kind of stories because it gives them some sense of comfort that, you know, the death is not the end. It is just, you know, a new beginning.
That's interesting. I never actually thought about that. I mean, I thought about people's belief in the paranormal in the sense that, okay, we have to find some way to explain things that we can't understand. Mm-hmm. Because the unknown itself is scary. But I never thought about it from that angle, that if we believe in something, even if it's something evil, something terrifying, something that we don't want to encounter, it means mm-hmm. that we're not it. Like, there's definitely mm-hmm. a world greater than us, and there's other things, and that has its own sense of hope attached to it. That's really interesting. Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about when that lady arrived from Boston and you received her, and what was your impression, and what happened? Tell us the story.
Yeah. Well, you know, she didn't look like she was possessed by a djinn. That's for sure. She looked a little jet lagged, and she was personable, and she seemed like someone I would, you know, I could connect with her, because I think for the same reason that she was there in Oman, she flew all the way just for this, and she didn't even stay like. She just came for that. She did. Wow. She went for Rukia for the exorcism, and then she was gone like the next day. So I like those kind of people. I like the kind of people that were, they take it to the, they see how far it can, they can take it, you know, and she seemed like that kind of lady. Yeah, but so it was me and her and my friend Hamid. He was he's a local guy, and he had never, he'd heard of Mualim Salim, but he never met him, but he went along as our translator. And so
he was a local who was he was game to go to the most haunted place in the country.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, Hamid is kind of a westernized guy. He spent a lot of time with expats, and okay, he's not your typical Omani, you know. He's most Omanis are like really friendly and you know, really willing to be like, you know, typical like Arab hospitable kind of people. But he's you know, more open-minded to, you know, these kind of things. Because he actually had a few experiences. Well, he had one experience before with a djinn. And, you know, if you talk to anyone who's who's in Islam or, you know, Muslim, then they'll almost everyone believes in djinn, and they almost all believe in angels too. But no one I've met has ever had an experience, a firsthand experience with an angel. But almost everyone has some kind of djinn story. So I don't know what that tells you. Yeah, but
that's a very astute observation. And when you come to think of it, although I will say one of my grandfathers claims to have had an encounter with angels in Mecca, but that's one out of every single Muslim I know. So it's a very rare.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay.
So you pick her up and you drive, and suddenly there's a storm.
Well, it had been brewing that day, you know. It was like at that time of the year, we get these winds from the north, the Shamalia, and sometimes it, you know, it collides with the moisture from the Gulf of Oman, and, you know, we get these big sandstorms. So yeah, it'd been brewing that day, and it was a pretty bad one, actually. I mean, the visibility was really low, and I was driving my little Kia Picanto, and it was getting battered around the road, on the road, and, you know, there's spattering of rain here and there, and everyone's driving with their lights on, and so
did any of these like, things feel like signs to you?
Yeah. I was like, this is like a movie, man. This is so cool. This is like, you know, this is like, we couldn't have picked a better day to go to Bahra, you know, for the atmosphere. So I was like, you know, I was into it. I was loving it. And I was like eating it up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So then you get to Mualim Salim's house, and tell me what that was like. What happened?
Well, I wasn't even sure he was going to be there. So there was a little tension in the air there because, you know, she flew come all this way. And, you know, I talked to him like a couple of days before, but we hadn't reconfirmed, you know. In the Middle East, you always have to like, you know, okay, you know, I'm going to be coming over tomorrow, you know, and then you reconfirm the day of, and then like, but when you're about to leave, you send a message, and then, you know, you have to like, this has to be a lot of reassurance of people just assume you're not going to come. So I didn't do any of that. I just did kind of like the Western thing, and like, okay, I'll see you in 2 days. And, you know, I didn't talk to him again. So, but he's retired. So, you know, where is he going to go? He's there at his house most of the time. So anyways, we got there and yeah, so I introduced him to this woman from Boston and my friend Hamid, and the storm was, it was kind of strange because the storm was all around us at this point, you know, and it was, but in I guess we're like in the eye of the storm or something. And, so yeah, that was a little weird. And there was like this, it was like this kind of electricity in the air, I guess from the, I don't know how electricity builds, but, or how that works, but there's like these little, you know, like, I guess it's static electricity or what it is in the clouds. So it was an eerie kind of atmosphere for, a day for an exorcism, you know? Yeah. And then what happened? Well, and then we went inside, and then the electricity went off, not immediately, but at some point, you know, they were going to do the wudu, which is like when you, you know, the ritual cleansing of the hands and feet, you know, it's because it is a, you know, sacred Islamic rite, and there's a certain protocol to be followed. But so, he decided to skip that because the electricity went out, and, you know, there was, So yeah, I guess the electricity went off because of the storm, you know, and so he lit a candle, and then there was like this, when he lit the candle, there was like this strange shadow across the wall. I don't know if it was from the candle or, and it's like this smell of sulfur. It could have been from the matches. I don't know, but it was really weird. And then
what did the shadow look like? What was the shape of the shadow?
It was just like, I don't know if you've ever been up for a few days in a row and you start to see things. It was like one of these shadows that you catch like out of the corner of your eye, and you're not sure if you really saw it or not, but it's enough to give you the creeps, you know, to give you a bet, you know.
Well, here's the question. Were you the only one to see it, or did everybody see it?
No, we all like turned our heads and like, okay, what the hell was that? You know? Okay. So yeah. So you know, the lights flickering, and then maybe it was some kind of, I don't know what the sound was, but it was like a strange kind of a whispering sound. At the same time, the shadow appeared, and then at that point, Mu'allim Salam started to recite apart from the last two chapters of the Quran, which are all about, you know, what to do in these kind of situations when someone is possessed by a jinn. So he started to recite that. And
what's going on with the woman who's possessed? Is she like lying on the floor? We've all seen The Exorcist. I'm assuming it wasn't that extreme.
No, she didn't float, unfortunately, but she floated. But I was at that point, I wouldn't have been surprised. Yeah. So, she lied back down on the middle of the room, and he was like reciting the Quran over her, and then her eyes rolled back into her head, and you could see like the whites of her eyes only, and she let out this moan. It was like some kind of like, I don't know, like a primal scream or something, and it was weird. It was like definitely nothing I've ever experienced before, you know.
Did you feel scared in the moment?
It was so strange that I felt like frozen, kind of like it was so weird. I was like, it was so like captivating, but the captivating kind of like watching a train wreck, you know, you can't pull away, you can't pull your eyes away. So it was Mondo Bizarro for sure. And
but did you get a sense that what was happening in front of you was like real?
That's the thing. I think that's what made me not want to look away, because I wanted to see like, okay, is this like actually happening? And it was like, because, you know, as he was reciting the Quran, she started to make this sound, and the, you know, the whites of her eyes, and the storm, and it was intense. You know, it was heavy. So I just saw what I saw. You know, I don't know if it was that's really what happened. You know, if it was, you know, the jinn was actually leaving her body, but you know, it seemed to me that's like I think that's what was happening. Yeah, you know? I mean, I can't. There's no way I could like confirm scientifically, you know, like this is for sure what happened. You know, it's just my experience and what I saw. But
that's also I'm assuming what the exorcist said was happening, and she reported that she felt was happening too, that this thing was leaving her body.
Yeah, afterwards she said that she felt like a sense of, you know, lightness. Like she was kind of disoriented at first, and she doesn't remember the point when we were like, you know, holding her down, because she started convulsing, you know, after this primal scream came out of her, and before she, you know, settled down. And at one point, I remember that this was a few years ago, so I'm just trying to, the Mu'allim had some holy water, and he like splashed her with it, and you know,
so she began convulsing, and you guys had to hold her.
Yeah, we had to like physically, like me and Hamid had to hold her arms down. So she's like started to like thrash about, and I guess this is at this point when the, you know, the jinn was leaving her body. or whatever it was, you know, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't a gen, maybe it was like her, you know, repressed, you know, traumatic memories, or I don't know. Right. Who knows what a gen really is, you know, maybe it was just like a way for the people in a long time ago to try to explain this kind of like epilepsy or like these other kind of, childhood traumas or something, you know, like
right.
post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't know what it was, but something was happening for sure.
So how long did this exorcism like take place?
It wasn't that long, actually. It was like maybe 10-15 minutes. I mean, once I got started. Yeah,
it's pretty quick. I mean, that's quick work to extract a djinn from somebody. It seems like it, given what we've seen, like in the movies and film and stuff. But and how was she afterwards?
Yeah, she seemed really happy that, I mean, she was kind of disoriented at first, and she really wanted a cigarette afterwards because it was like a pretty intense experience for her, I guess. But she felt that it was worth her while, you know, to come all that way to Oman to, you know, to do the research, to find me, and to go visit this guy in Bahla. You know.
And I'm assuming he like charges for his services, right? Like, how does he make a living?
Yeah, he does. And that's just up to the client. I mean, I think she gave him like $100 or something like that.
Oh, whatever the client wants to give.
Yeah, yeah. There's no like, he doesn't have like a set price list on the door.
So your story ends, your story about her ends kind of mysteriously, because it seems like later on she feels like actually she is still possessed.
Yeah.
So you guys stayed in touch basically after she left, you stayed in touch?
No, we didn't, not for a long time. And then I guess it was just last year, I started to think about the experience and thought, you know, that's kind of a crazy story. You know, I should write that up. And so I contacted her again just to check up, you know, say, like, hey, you know, how'd it go with, you know, did your visit to Oman, did it really help you? And she told me that it did for a while, you know, it did. It definitely brought her some kind of peace, but she had to go on and do some further research. And she ended up going to Indonesia because there's a lot of possessions in Indonesia, and there's lots of people who do the Rukia there. And she told me a really crazy story about, you know, that involved blood and maggots, and there was some kind of nefarious, like, not everybody in Indonesia who does these exorcisms is on the level. Right. So there's some nefarious things going on. And I think she encountered one of those, if I remember correctly, she encountered one of those guys who was, basically kind of doing like a parlor trick to satisfy his clients. And, you know, with the kind of like what they did in the, I can't remember when it was popular, but at one point in the United States, the seances, the contacting the dead was like a really popular fun right. thing to do at parties, you know, right. And they would bring in these mediums, and there's a lot of people like that in Indonesia who do this, but, you know, in the Islamic world, not just for fun, but, you know, for profit and for, because people would like so fervently believe and, you know, that they're possessed by these djinn, they're willing to go to any length. And then if they get these dramatic results and, you know, there's blood and maggots and weird things happening, like you see in the horror films, that they have a huge horror film industry in Indonesia, by the way. But anyway, so if you see these kind of things and you feel like you're getting your money's worth, and, you know, and it creates more business for the guy. So, that happened to her. And then I think she finally did find someone who's legitimate, and I haven't heard from her since. That was last year, the last time I heard from her. But she also, I think she went to Malaysia because there's a big, because Malaysia is a Muslim country. And so there's lots of people who are possessed there. And then there's the whole Malaysian slant on how exorcisms are done and, you know, what that entails. And so I think there's so much I don't know about it. You know, what I experienced was just like a little, you know, like a little snapshot of like a much bigger picture of, if you're looking into paranormal phenomenon in right. the Islamic world.
I'm guessing, every kind of culture has its own
like, you know, angle to the exorcisms that like resonates with the locals and makes sense given like the context and stuff. And that's also something I haven't really considered. I thought it would be kind of formulaic, but yeah, that makes sense. It's really interesting. So for you, have you thought about like, what other things, I mean, this is not the only stuff you write about. You write about like your work is like about a lot of different like cultural aspects of that region. Yeah. But is this something that you've thought about pursuing more in depth? Like, is it something you still think about, or you're just like, well, that was interesting and I'm done. It is what it is.
No, I mean, I would love to go to Indonesia to look more into like what's happening there. Cause I think that's a really interesting, situation there because of the mix of beliefs there. You know, they have before Islam came, there was there was Hinduism, and then before Hinduism they had the Javanese had their own animistic beliefs, and those beliefs mixed with the Hinduism, and then they brought some of those beliefs with them into Islam, and so like this really interesting mix of beliefs, and they all seem to coexist fairly peacefully, you know, like when there wasn't a riot or something going on. But I think the mix of that would be really interesting to see. And I would like to go visit some of these charlatans, you know, to see, or just try to sort out who's real and who's not, you know. I think that would be, a fascinating piece to go, especially with someone who was like, you know, truly felt like that they were actually affected and were possessed by a djinn, you know. I think that would be a pretty moving piece, you know.
Have you, do you still live in Oman?
No, I'm in the UAE now, but I'm in Czech Republic for the summer, and I'm living in the UAE now.
Okay. Have something similar there, or is it kind of a different culture, much more like kind of progressive there?
Well, it's not famous for having, you know, there's no Bahla in the UAE, but, there is, some degree of, you know, the same beliefs there because it isn't, a Muslim country. And so, occasionally it comes up when I'm with my students, you know, we talk about these kind of things come up, and sometimes we'll talk about jinn and angels and, you know, these different beliefs. And so the people there believe in them too, you know. So, and you know, most of my students have some kind of story that involves a jinn. So, and there, you know, the first person that, the woman from Boston that I helped, she went to go see, was actually in Sharjah. So there are people who do exorcisms there too.
Well, I don't know if I'd be able to, but I'd love to speak to this lady. And given especially the fact that she's kind of traveled the world, that's something that you're taking very seriously if you're going to be that committed to addressing this issue. That's a possibility, but what are your kind of like plans going forward? Do you have any other anything in the pipeline, and where do you write? Because I'd love for our listeners to check out your pieces.
Yeah, most of my stuff you can find on the Matador Network. If you just Google Baxter Jackson Matador, the list should pop up of most of my pieces that I've written for them over the years.
I'm assuming you're open to other people reaching out with their djinn stories.
Yeah, I would love to hear them for sure. I'm fascinated by the supernatural, and people have had firsthand experiences like that. So yeah.
Well, sure, I'd love it if you ever returned to Oman and did like a ghost hunters type of episode in Bahla. That would be a lot of take some video.
I would love to do that. That'd be cool. Like Ghostbusters, the Oman edition.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, thank you so much. This has been really interesting. And I guess I just want to end with one final kind of question to you, although I feel like you've answered it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And that is this: after everything kind of you've lived in the region, what, 13 years now, and everything you've kind of experienced firsthand and stories you've heard, like, where do you kind of fall on the spectrum of like, do you believe djinn exist?
I don't know. I know what I saw. I know what other people have experienced. I'd like to believe. I guess you could say that I'm sort of still agnostic. I don't know for sure. Yeah.
You don't know that they don't.
Right. That's right. What about you? You're Muslim, right?
I am. I'm Muslim, yeah.
Do you believe in...
Well, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, the way I think about it is like if I am a person of faith, like pretty much of any faith, and I have some belief in something supernatural, this is how religion is. And mm-hmm. so then how do you draw a line where I believe this, but that's going too far, right? Like, so mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. me, I, like you said, if you believe in angels and you believe in God and you believe in Satan, then like, why are jinns way too fantastical? Like that's, oh, that's just out of the realm of,
yeah. But what let's not go too far now.
Right. Let's not go too far. So it's not too far for me. I do absolutely believe there are phenomena that we don't understand. We might not ever understand. I don't think everything that people experience, they think is jinn is always jinn. I think mm-hmm. there are often times, and I've seen this myself in my own life, where people have, let's say, deep mental health issues, or there mm-hmm. are trauma. There's so many other things that happen that we might interpret that way, or it's just easier to deal with that way, maybe. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I mean, would I hang out in the castle in Bahla at night? Probably not. I'm not trying to court. I don't want to bring him home. And honestly, right. to be honest, Baxter, and in this interview series, the very first episode, I hope you get a chance to listen to it, will be yeah. me with my husband talking about like our personal experiences. So I have had some experiences that I'm like, what else could it be? But like a jinn or something.
Yeah.
Anyhow, but anyway, thank you again. I really appreciate your time, and I'm going to continue to follow your work, and I hope you get to Indonesia and fill us all in. And, you know, I would totally read that and watch that.
Okay. Hey, thanks. Thanks a lot for this interview.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Now, there are as many people in the world with jinn stories as there are jinn. So if you have one you'd like to share, make sure to email it to me at thehiddenjinn@gmail.com. That's thehiddenjinn, thehiddenjinn@gmail.com. And until next time, remember, we are not alone.
The Hidden Jinn is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. The podcast is written and hosted by Rabia Chaudhry and produced by Miranda Hawkins and Trevor Young, with executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Our theme song was created by Patrick Cortez. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.